Okay, this is Ken Samuelson, and I'm here in Carolina Meadows with Mr. Ralph Todd, who's a World War II veteran. And my address is 4019 Farrington Post in Pittsburgh, North Carolina, actually Farrington Village. And my telephone number is 919-542-0674. And today's date, what is today's date, Ralph? It's the 7th.
7th, yeah. Right.
Okay, April the 7th on a Monday, 2008. And I'm here with Mr. Ralph Todd. And Ralph, would you identify yourself for the listening audience and your family or wherever else?
I am Ralph R. Todd. I live at Carolina Meadows, and I was born...
That's Chapel Hill?
That's at Chapel Hill, right. And I was born in Tapas City, North Carolina, in 1912, December 1912. My dad was a railroader, and we moved around quite a bit. And I lived...
Did you live in North Carolina?
In North Carolina a couple of times. We slipped over into Virginia and South Carolina, but primarily in North Carolina.
And where did you go to school, Ralph? Did you go?
I went to school. I went to elementary. I started school in Harney County. Mm-hmm. But we moved to Greensboro, North Carolina, when I was in elementary school, mm-hmm. and I went to Caldwell School there, and then later I went to what was then Greensboro High School. It mm-hmm. is now. It is
something else.
Something else.
Did you graduate from high school?
Yes, I did. I graduated from high school there in 1930.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
And I lived at that time. We were in deep depression.
Oh yes.
And
that's about the time I was born. A year later. Yeah.
And I, when my dad was out of job down at Harney Lillian, he was the station agent, mm-hmm. and he was bumped. That is, he lost his job.
Oh,
and as we all know, about one third of the working population was similarly out of work then. Mm-hmm. So he finally got his job in Greensboro, North Carolina, and that's why we moved to Greensboro. There were six kids.
Mm-hmm. You had six, including your brother and sister.
Including all of us.
Okay.
And
so it's pretty tough for your dad to feed that family.
Indeed, it was. I remember as it was yesterday. My dad, he called me Buddy. He says, "Buddy, things are tough, and we don't have to have a different arrangement. You're going to have to, you're on your own. I can give you shelter over your head, but you're going to have buy your books and your clothes and all your needs, take care of all your needs. You're going to have to really hustle. You're going to have help me with the garden to put food on the table." And
this is while you're in high school or in school so far?
I was still in elementary school.
I was still in elementary school.
About 12 years old. And he said, "You're going to help me with the garden to help put food on the table." Well, I thought that was a big man. I was kind of proud of it. And so I worked about every department store in town, I think. Food store, typewriter repair, theater supply, warehouse, soap warehouse, and just about everywhere I could get a job. And I get a job one day and beg for it. And then next day I'd report to work. And the proprietor said, I made a mistake. I thought I could use you, but things are tough. I looked at my books, I can't hire you. And that happened many, many times. I worked at a fruit store from 7 o'clock on Saturday morning until 1 o'clock Sunday morning for 75 cents.
Whoa.
But a nickel went a long way in those days.
True,
you could buy a hot dog for a nickel, and and a Coke for a nickel, go to the show for a dime.
Yeah.
And it stretched pretty good ways.
And so, did your father ask you to help support the house by providing some of that 75 cents to him?
No, I wasn't on a ration basis. He just asked me to give my mother a couple of dollars a week when I could afford it.
I see.
To give her some spending money.
Right.
So, at about halfway through high school, I'd taken up the trumpet and I played dance bands on Friday and Saturday, Friday and Saturday nights usually. Mm-hmm. And we'd make $3 a night, and that was big bucks in those days.
That was, yeah, that was pretty good money.
So that together with my work, I existed pretty good, but pretty well. But,
now, were your brothers and sisters doing the same?
They were doing the same while they were the oldest. No, I had two older brothers, and I had one older sister, and I had two younger sisters. Mm-hmm. Six of us in all, mm-hmm. and they were with me part of the time. About the time I hit high school, my older brothers went out on their own. Mm-hmm. But I continued with the scheme of things that I had started with, and I graduated from high school. I got a job with a broker, and he paid me $7 a week, a stockbroker. Mm-hmm. And while I was with the working there, this was in the Jefferson Standard Life Insurance Building.
Yes, uh-huh.
You know that.
In Greensboro.
Mm-hmm. And he came to buy to sell me some insurance. And he says, if you will buy some policy for me, I'll get you a better job. So he got me a job with the Texas Oil Company. And I bought a $10,000 policy from him. And
that was a big policy.
That was. And I was going to be paid $100 a month, and that was big
good
bucks.
Money.
That
yeah.
was big bucks.
Good money. Yeah.
Going salary then was about $60 a month, mm-hmm. $15 a week. That's what most everybody made, but that had a regular job. So I was in high cotton, and so I started courting a pretty little girl, and I wasn't making any time with her, taking her to the drugstore a couple of times a week and buying her a 10-cent Coke and taking her to the movies and once a week. So I got put in desperate, what should I do? So I finally bought a car. I think the list on it was $700 on time, of course.
Yeah.
I just paid the down payment. Rode up and down Main Street in Greensboro with a pretty girl by my side, and I was a dude. And and finally she said yes. And before she changed her mind, I rushed her to the preacher. And so we got him out of the house, and we said our do's and our wills, and, you know, they use them.
Right.
And we got through, and I told him I turned to my girlfriend. I had never done this thing before. And I says, what next? I said, what do we do next? And she said, I think we give him a gratuitous of some kind. I said, well, I got $3. How much you got? And she gave me some change. So we paid him $5 and rode in a white horse to live happy forever after. But pretty soon I decided I couldn't afford a new car and a new wife too at the same time. One of them had to go, and that was a hard decision, but I finally decided to let the car go and keep the wife. And that was a good decision. And we lived happy for 55 years, and that was the best $5 investment that anybody ever made.
God bless you, Ron. That's great.
I have an awful thought since then that, by golly, we should have had at least a little church wedding. But on second thought, we could not have properly afforded it for $5.
Yeah.
So she never complained about it, and I was perfectly happy. She was a doll. She was a great lady. and came along.
What time frame was this? When did you actually get married?
1936.
1936.
1936. Huh?
And you were still working then. You were.
I was still working with the Texas Oil Company.
Texas Oil Company. And what were you doing for them, Ralph?
Well, I was office manager.
This is in Greensboro.
Greensboro.
Okay.
It was tough times, and finished high school, and I initially started to go to Guilford College, and pretty soon I realized I could not cut it, couldn't pay the tuition. They didn't have the financial assistance programs at that time, and if I had told my dad to help me with college, he would have thought I'd just lost my cookies. Because he was still struggling with his low-paying job, so I never asked him. And more about that later. But I dropped out, and I was working with the Texas Oil Company, and came World War II when I was with that company.
In 1938, you made a decision to join the National Guard, right?
I was training at night. You're right. And I was going, I think it was once.
Now, you were a private?
Yeah, I was a private.
Private, okay.
I was a private.
And they were training you in all things military, infantry? What branch of, it was Army, I know, but what area of expertise were they training you in?
Well, as I recall, it was a branch immaterial. I just recall we were doing the usual drilling, and I never learned any particularly, especially as an infantry artillery, logistics of any kind, but I was well trained in the basics. And
why did you join the National Guard?
Why?
Yeah,
good question.
Was it extra money?
There was a little money involved, but all my friends were getting ready to join the Army and that sort of thing. They had pulled out the National Guard, and they were federalized.
Uh-huh.
And the Home Guard...
This is 1938 now?
This was 2 or 3 years before I went in at 42. That's a good date. I don't know recall precisely the date I went in. But I was with the Home Guard, not the National Guard, because the National Guard had been federalized, and we replaced the National Guard, and they called it the Home Guard to take care of any.
Was this a federal or was it state? Or do you remember?
I don't remember.
Okay. I
was a private, and
have an army uniform.
We had some fatigues. And we did the same thing that the National Guard had done, trained once a week. And
were you paying any attention then, Ralph? I guess most people probably weren't, but were you paying much attention to what was happening in Europe? I mean, did that concern you?
We were very closely following what was in Europe,
did you ever feel like, hey, we're going to be in it?
I think most of the people my age did feel one way or the other, we're going to be involved. Of course, I was recently married, and I was in no particular desire to leave my pretty bride, but we knew the unknown was out there, and we were going to be involved somehow. And we were right, of course, and we were paying very close attention to what was going on in Europe, Hitler, and gobbling up the little countries around him.
I guess
him.
You saw the newsreels probably at the movies and all, didn't you?
All the time, And we were very intensely following the news in Europe, and particularly Hitler's advances in all the countries around him. And I guess the next step of any importance was when we finally did in 42 get involved.
December 7th, 1941, you're talking about Pearl Harbor?
December 7th, 1941, I wasn't in at that time.
Right.
No.
But you heard about it.
Oh, everybody was right on top of the radio.
What did you think about that?
Well,
do you remember what your thoughts were?
It was, I remember everybody had very intense thoughts about it. And we thought that, well, this is the Armageddon. We're in now.
Yeah, we're in.
There's no end. And sure enough, when a day or so, Roosevelt declared war.
Did anything change for you immediately at your Home Guard unit? Did they change anything the way
no,
you did things?
No, we continued at the moment. I don't think that was a temporary thing. The Home Guard, I don't think they could be federalized because their only intent was to take care of local disturbances and that sort of thing.
Okay.
But anyway, yes, indeed, when Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor,
you recall where you were?
I was at my home, and we were all huddled around the radio. The radio was a new thing in those days.
Yeah, they interrupted the broadcast.
Everything popped off, and this came over the news. And I think it was the next day that Roosevelt declared war on Japan, and then Germany declared war on us, and we were in, as you know. We went from nothing militarily in the United States. We had nothing when the war started. And they had to move fast, so they conceived every way in the world to build up our military. And in our hometown, They went back to the old method, like they did the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, pulling in from a community, and they picked a leader there who was Joe Carruthers, and he was a representative, a North Carolina representative, and an attorney there in Greensboro, and he picked his officers there at the blessing of the federal government, and they were going to be officers in a new company, and their responsibility was to form a company.
And now, how long after Pearl Harbor did this happen?
This was 3 or 4 months. Followed immediately.
Yeah.
So we got a bunch together, 200 guys local guys out of Greensboro, and we also picked out a Winston-Salem and High Point, and we signed up a company, and the officers went away, sent them away to learn how to be officers,
right?
And they sent the enlisted men down to Camp Sutton, which is an old CCC camp.
Mm-hmm.
And Dustin and Dirty, but
so you were sent down there.
Yeah, we were sent down. The guys were sent down there.
This was like 4 months after, like April.
Like April.
How much advance notice did they give you before you had to leave?
Well,
did you have some notice?
They spent about a couple of months in signing up the company, getting volunteers.
Getting ready to go. So you knew you were going.
When we, I decided fairly soon that with all the my buddies out of Greensboro that we were going in and going in together.
And what did your wife think about this?
Well, she didn't discourage me, but she was pretty fearful what was down the road.
Sure.
As all the other girls were.
Absolutely.
But I knew that I'd be going in, and better to go in. She did too. And better to go in with people you knew than a bunch of strangers.
Yeah.
So that was a plus.
Now, what did they name your company so-and-so?
They learned.
Company A, B, C?
Company T.
Company T.
Company T. I don't know where they got its name from.
Do you happen to remember what division you were in and so forth?
At that time, we were just a company, and we were not attached to a division, a corps, or a battalion. But they had other units down there training in that area at the same time. But we were an independent company at that time.
How did you get down to Camp Sutton? How did they take you down there?
Well, it was very informal. The families took us down there to, and we just got there the best way we could.
Oh, okay. They didn't send a troop train or anything?
No, not at that time. It was rather initially quite informal.
The best way you could get there, huh?
And the leaders of that Company T were two men. There's a fresh lieutenant, second lieutenant, out of West Point, mm-hmm. and a good old crusty first sergeant. And that's all there was to train that company.
Those were the only professional
soldiers. Those were the only professionals when we first hit Camp Sutton, exactly. Okay.
And where is Camp Sutton again? What state?
It's in North Carolina, Charlotte. It was in North Carolina.
Oh, that's one I haven't heard of yet.
Camp Sutton. Well, very few people have.
Oh, you said it was a CCC camp.
CCC camp. Yeah, that's right. And they put the troops in where they could, you know, right. in those days. And I had, of course, a lot of, I had, couldn't, I couldn't make it with, at the college, Guilford College. Uh-huh. So I came back and went to Greensboro Business College. And I had learned how to type and do bookkeeping and all that stuff. And so when they formed the company, I was, there were a lot of vacancies, you know.
Yeah.
Private first class,
sure.
Sergeant, tech sergeant, first sergeant,
sure.
and on down the line. So immediately, since I was a hotshot administrator, I started helping with administrative work with the company,
right.
and also. I sat in on some of the court martials later on, the summers and that sort of thing. And I also had training with the Home Guard, and I was drilling some of the guys, and so I went to tech sergeant pretty quick.
Yeah, no doubt.
Private first class.
Well, you had good training, actually.
Compared to most.
Yeah.
So I was forced in that regard. We stayed there a while, and then they sent us, the Fort Benning in South Carolina, Fort Benning. And we got a little more training down there. And then soon thereafter, they sent us out to Fort Lewis, Washington, across the country. For a spell. And at that time, I was tech sergeant.
So you took your basic training basically at Camp Sutton, is that the idea?
Camp Sutton and Fort Benning.
Oh, Fort Benning, too.
Yeah, the two, yes.
Now, when you were those places, you were doing drilling and learning how to shoot a rifle and all
that
stuff.
Yeah, and as a private, how to clean the toilets.
Yeah, right.
And I did that. And then after that, we went to Fort Lewis, and we got some more concentrated training out there. They had uh-huh. the facilities, and some of the guys had advanced a little bit, and then we filled out the company.
Yeah.
And the officers who had gone off somewhere else to train how to be officers, they had joined us by that time, and they were with us. And while we were there, we got some concentrated training at Fort Lewis, Washington. And while there, I was tapped to go to OCS.
How many men were in your company?
200.
Roughly
200.
It was a typical company.
A typical company, yeah.
Okay.
Right. And they tapped me, and I took the little IQ thing and the interview thing to see if I had a sense, I guess, and sent me off to Fort. Sent me to Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland,
uh-huh.
and for 3 months, and there we worked our tail off for 3 months, and then I came out as a second lieutenant. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And could you believe all that happened so fast?
So fast, yeah. I did not.
And what time frame was this when you graduated as second lieutenant, Ralph? This would have been like September, October, somewhere along
September, October, something like that.
Later on in the year, anyway. 1942.
Somewhere hidden in the in my records, but
okay.
But something like
late
that.
Late 42.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I was I didn't go back to my old company because at that time they were in North Africa. And
they were already in North Africa. Oh, my gosh.
So I went to I was assigned to a new company, and we were I told you previously that I had we were originally tabbed to be a maintenance company.
Uh-huh.
And but they changed it to ammunition company, so we were
ammunition. Okay.
So we went to, they sent that new company to Portsmouth to do some loading and unloading of ammunition, get the feel of it, smell of it.
You weren't part of a division yet then? You're still independent?
No, we were still a company.
Still just
and amazingly, we were a single company until we hit the hit the landing in England.
Really?
And we went out and trained there, and then we went out the California-Arizona maneuver area to do some desert training because we were tapped to go to North Africa.
Yes.
Follow my own kind. But the last minute, they decided we were going to England to do the landing, the invasion of Europe. And we were still shipped over as a
independent.
We shipped.
Now, of course, this is we're talking about late 42. Now, the invasion didn't happen until June of 44. So, what did you do between now and then?
Well, we were training, and we were at Portsmouth, Virginia, for a good spell, but I don't have
the. Now your desert training. Do you have any conception of how long that lasted?
We went out there in August, and boy was it hot.
That was August.
August
42.
August. That would be August of.
It would have been 43.
I think that'd be 43 years.
Okay, so you did a lot between that
bumping around stations and training and school and here and there. Yeah.
Now you're training out in the desert. How did that go? What they were training you for? You know, hot weather.
Yeah, the hot weather and
how to take care of yourself and stay alive in the hot weather.
We were playing around with the boxes and storage and quite a distance tables. How to stack it so that if one sack blew, the concussion wouldn't blow the next sack. And we were getting pretty deeply into our.
This is all related to ammunition.
Ammunition, yeah. Okay. Ammunition. We were just supposed to be.
Did you have any accidents out there?
No. We ran into a lot of rattlesnakes.
What did you wear on the desert? What did they have you wear? What did you wear out there? So hot.
We dressed pretty carelessly. There weren't any women around on the desert.
I mean, you have shorts and a t-shirt or something?
We had a t-shirt on and shorts. But it was miserably hot. Even at night, it cooled off a lot because the sand doesn't hold the heat so well. But
was this in effect combat training? Were they training you for combat at this point?
We got most of our combat training at Fort Lewis, Washington.
Okay.
Advanced under fire and it was a lot of ammunition really.
Crawling under
the barbed wire and that sort of thing. We got a lot of that at Port Lewis, Washington. Out there, it was mostly done how to endure the heat.
The ammunition that you have done about like for your 105s and 155s or what?
The 30 caliber, 45 caliber. 105, 155, 8 inches,
uh-huh.
And no chemical stuff.
No chemicals.
But
no mortars or anything of that nature?
No mortars at that point. Okay. We handled the mortars later in action, yeah.
So when you left there, do you recall where you
While there, my first daughter was born back in Greensboro, and when we got orders to go to England, I got a week's leave, and I saw my daughter for a week.
Yeah.
And I didn't see her again for 2 years. And then after that, I joined my unit.
Were you ever able to talk to your wife by telephone or anything during that time?
We
corresponded.
We were in communication quite frequently.
Could you actually get a telephone line to her, or did you mainly correspond?
I remember we did get into town a few times, nearby town like Phoenix and Falstaff and places like that. We get to a telephone and
you could make a call.
We could call home, yeah. And when I left a week's leave, we went to Boston and departed, and we went with a big a massive ships.
Uh-huh.
You
went over in a convoy?
In a convoy, absolutely.
Now, the ship you went across on, do you recall what kind of ship it was or anything? Or was it wasn't the Queen Mary, was it?
No, it was a Liberty ship. We all got sick as
an old Liberty ship.
They rocked. They can mass produce them, you know.
Oh, yeah. Turn them out once a week or something.
Yeah, that's right. But they weren't very pleasant because everybody got sick because they just wallow in every wave that came by.
What kind of sleeping facilities did you have on that Liberty ship? Do you remember? Did you have a cot downstairs, down below?
Stacked up to the ceiling down below. I know we're stacked up to the ceiling. I remember three or four in a row.
Did you ever sleep out on the deck, or did you sleep down?
I slept inside. But if you got real, real sick, it helped to go out on the deck and bring you some of that cold air.
Did they have any kind of decent food? Do you remember aboard that ship?
Yeah. The food, all the way through, a lot of the guys bitched about the food. Of course, we all do that. People bitch about the food.
Yeah, you're not happy unless you're griping about something.
That's right. what the general said, if the soldiers stop pitching, watch out! Something's going to explode.
That's right.
So that's a normal state of things.
Yeah.
To pitch. But
now, did you know where you were going when you got on this Liberty ship?
We knew that we were going to England.
Going to England. And we didn't go to North Africa, but you went.
We went to England. Matter of fact, I ship peeled off and went to. Scotland, something like Firth or Forth or Fifth, up there. That was the name of the place.
Now this is late 43, August of 43 or so. Is that what you're talking about?
That was in there, and
so you went to Scotland.
I went to Scotland and disembarked and trained on a train. I went to London, and we were there about a week.
Uh-huh.
And then they sent us down to Land's End, which is the southwest part of England, a very delightful place to wait. And we waited there for quite a time. We were still just a company.
Still an independent
still
company.
A company.
What kind of facilities did you have to stay in down near Land's End?
Quonset huts.
Stayed in Quonset huts. And were there a lot of men down there at that time?
There was a lot of people scattered up and down the coast there, but we were an entity ourselves.
Yeah.
So
what was the highest ranking officer in your company?
Captain. Uh-huh.
So he didn't have any direct, I guess he had a direct superior somewhere, but he didn't have any battalion or what have you above him then.
No, I remember we were still in close touch with London. That's where the chief was. That's when the headquarters was at that time.
Yeah.
And I was ran back and forth with the courier officer to see what was going on, maybe get late orders.
You were the courier?
And to get our late orders at any, and that was fun because
you could get out
on the train. I went back and forth on the train.
Well, you were one of the few people who were able to leave the base,
was
anybody allowed to leave the base?
We were confined. The company was confined
so you
to the
could
base.
Not, you could not get off the base unless you had a job like yours.
You had to have a mission, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So you took the train into London, and how long a trip would that be? Was that an hour or so?
I don't recall precisely, but it was something like 2 or 3 hours.
Oh my gosh, that's a long time.
That's the furthest ship.
When you went to London, where did you go?
I went to. They had the regular military quarters there.
I mean, who did you get your orders from?
We were getting them out of Shafe.
You got them out of Shafe headquarters.
Shafe, yeah.
Really?
Who
would you actually go see? Who did they say you had to see? Who was?
Well, I would. My contact person was an officer and a name in Shafe, and I don't remember who it was.
But he was an officer in Shafe.
Okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. And with his credentials, and I had mine, and I had my secret coverage.
Did you carry a valise? Or a little a briefcase or something?
I had a little briefcase.
Was it tied to your wrist or anything of that nature, or what?
It was. I had to keep it on my person all the time, and sleep with it under my pillow, and that sort of thing. But it wasn't tied to my belt or wrist.
Yeah, right. Okay, it wasn't chained to your wrist or anything like that.
And
you never saw the orders. You just carried them.
No, I never saw the orders. No.
So you delivered it to your captain
my commanding officer, right? Right. And we were there in terms of a long time until the day of the landing. As a matter of fact, we got our orders about a week before, and we didn't go in on the first wave.
Let me digress a little bit back to your time. Now, when you were confined to your... where everybody else except you, maybe one of the few people who could get away from your facilities there. Did you ever have occasion to interact with any of the British people? Off the base. On the train and so forth going in, were you allowed to speak to anybody?
I had tight security on those trips. Yeah.
You couldn't talk to anybody.
Couldn't talk to anybody. Right. Now on the base, we were not confined at all. We could go out in the town at night.
Oh, you weren't confined to the base. You could go out to the town.
And there was some farmers around there. We'd go over and have tea with them sometime in the afternoon.
Did you get friendly with any of them?
Yeah.
Did you personally have any families that you got friendly with?
Or? Yeah, there's a farming family near our place there, and he owned that whole area through there. He was a big-time farmer.
Yeah.
And he had some kids, and we'd go and have tea with him and have a little conversation, and they were very... very nice to us, and we enjoyed them.
Do you think they appreciated you as a U.S. soldier there helping them?
Yeah, they did. It showed.
It did.
Indeed, it did, yeah.
That's great.
And they did.
Now, what did you know about what was happening in the war? How did you keep up to date with what was happening? What was
we knew that we were going across the channel sometime.
Right. You knew that?
But that was top secret.
But everybody knew that.
They knew it'd be sometime.
They didn't know when.
But the date.
Even Eisenhower didn't know when, for sure.
But
until the last minute.
But one interesting thing that you probably knew about, you heard about, I'm sure, the slapping incident by Blood and Guts George Patton in Sicily.
Yeah.
He was going to the hospital there to cheer up his soldiers.
Right.
And he was complimenting them all on the service, and he hit the one guy that was in there for emotional reasons. And And he didn't believe in that sort of nonsense. Right. He even
called him a coward or something.
Yeah, he kind of slapped him.
Yeah.
And it got out in the press, and he was in the doghouse, and Pitt and Eisenhower had to do something with him. And he came upon the brilliant idea of putting him on ice, but the Germans thought he was the best general in the staple.
Right.
And they thought surely he would lead the invasion. So Patton put him...
Eisenhower put him in charge of a
fictitious
phony
invasion
army,
way down the coast there.
Right.
And on the map, it looks like he can jump across it. I've forgotten the name of the place. But anyway, we show some activity in there to make them think that we were turning in troops and logistics and so forth.
Now, when they did that, did they build any rubber tanks or inflatable tanks to make it look like there was a lot going on?
I'm sure there was all kinds of deception going on there. I'm not interested.
You weren't involved in it?
No, I just know about it. And it worked to a point because they did concentrate a lot of troops in that area, thinking that was it, because Patton was sure to lead the invasion, and there's activity there, and this was the best place to invade.
Right. Yeah.
And
Calais, I believe it was.
You're right, Calais. Yeah, you're right.
I thought they would.
I couldn't think of it. But anyway, had he not done that, it's questionable whether that invasion would have been a success.
Yeah. Definitely.
Because at one point I read that Bradley almost called it off. It was getting too rough.
Yeah.
And it was just a little difference, you know. It's like your basketball game. There's a little difference where you win or lose.
Uh-huh. That's the difference.
Exactly. But anyway, it was a howling success. And we went, I went over, still as a unit, to...
When did you get your orders, Ralph, that you knew you were going to be going? Now, I understand the 5th and 6th were, you know, they almost did it on the 5th, and then they called some of the vessels back and so forth.
I don't remember specific, but as I recall, about a week in advance before...
How did it come down to you? What did they say
our commander says, we're going to report and aboard a ship on a given date, so get yourselves ready, and that was all I knew, and that's all I needed to know.
Yes, right.
Now,
when you get ready, you were still involved with ammunition, right? At that point,
At Land's End, we weren't handling a piece of ammunition at all.
Oh, you weren't?
No, we were not. We were
more of a general logistics company?
Yeah, it was a logistics company, and we were for the most part marking time.
Yeah, right. And you're just waiting?
No, waiting for the orders.
Uh-huh. Waiting for the big push.
We got our orders, and we went over the latter part of that day, which was, June 6th, yeah. And had we been down on the first wave, we wouldn't be here today talking to you, probably.
Right. Now, which beach did you land at?
Omaha.
You landed on Omaha? That's the worst one, yeah.
Yeah, that was the
worst. They're all bad.
Omaha was the worst. And,
when you went to Omaha Beach, did the vessel that you were on, was it one where the front LST, where the front dropped down?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh.
And what was your mission when you got there?
Our mission was to unload supplies, primarily ammunition. But if we're not working with ammunition, anything, and get them to the units and soldiers as quickly as we could.
So your job was to get whatever ships were bringing material over there to get it off, get it on the beach so the people could use it.
Right. Uh-huh.
Now, what was the condition of the beach at that point? How secure was that beach when you got there?
It was reasonably secure. The main thing, we were getting sporadic artillery fire and a little sniper fire now and then.
Did you have many casualties at this point?
In our particular unit, we did not have any casualties.
Okay.
There were a lot of kids still on the beach.
What did you see when you got at the beach? I mean, tell me, what describe that.
Well,
what did you see? Because they couldn't have cleaned it up.
A lot of debris on the beach and just a horrible mess.
I'm sure you saw still a lot of casualties on the beach.
There were some casualties still on the beach, and they were still the guys were still being evacuated.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know the route of evacuation. I'm sure they're trying to get them back on the ships and get them back to hospitals.
Now, when you came in, your vessel just unloaded, and mm-hmm. you got off, and then the vessel backed out and went back to pick somebody else.
Yeah, but it was the greatest mass of ships of all kinds that I guess ever. But
the largest invasion in history.
Yeah, in the history, exactly.
We're going to flip this now.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
So you got to Omaha Beach.
Yep.
You're unloaded.
And we unloaded.
And it isn't a pretty sight. It's an ugly sight.
It's an ugly sight.
And what were you unloading then at that point?
Everything conceivable. You think of they're trying to get ammunition. No replacement as quick as it could, and that was our primary job. But any kind of logistics, transportation items, and
now did they assign you to a division at this point, or a battalion, or whatever?
Yeah, they at that time and concurrent with all that, they pulled Patton away from his fictitious spot down the coast. And we formed the 62nd Ammunition Battalion there on the beach, and we were to supply Patton, General Patton, with his ammunition.
And he was a Third Army?
Third Army. He was Third Army. Yeah. And we formed the 62nd Ammunition, Ordnance Ammunition Battalion to supply his ammunition.
Yeah.
And after, since we got through with the temporary work there on the beach,
and you started to specialize in ammunition,
exactly. Okay.
When you say ammunition, you're talking about all kinds of ammunition.
All kinds of ammunition.
From an M1 or carbine to a 155 or whatever.
30 caliber, and pistols 45
and machine guns, whatever,
and the artillery items and that sort of thing.
That's heavy work.
And we also, a battalion has three companies, and we had those under us and I went in those.
Now, you were a second lieutenant at that point?
At that point.
And what were your specific responsibilities?
I was the operations officer for the battalion. And my job was to every night, sometimes it took all night. The signal people kept us communication lines up, and to talk with the division ammunition officer and see how many rounds of ammunition he had expended throughout the last 24 hours, by caliber and by type. And then I was my response was get that information back to the base.
Where was your base? In England?
In England for a while, but immediately they set it up on the beaches there.
Okay.
And that constituted.
So they were unloading all kinds of ammunition there on the beach.
And everything else, yeah.
And you had to replace. You talked to the fighting units to see what ammunition they'd used.
Uh huh.
Your job was to report back and then make sure that it got up.
The transportation boys had the Red Ball Express, they called it.
Yeah, right.
And they rode 24 hours a day, and you could call it back, and they'd have the ammunition up to the depots the next day.
Now, were you at a depot?
We were as close to the Patton's troops as we could get.
Yeah, okay.
And of course, we all kept moving.
So the ammunition came from England to the depot that's on the beach?
Once I called the Red Ball Express, got it up there, and we assumed they got it to the right place. And we also, I had the responsibility of establishing new depots as he moved forward.
Okay. So your responsibility was to gather the information so the Red Ball Express guys could pick up the proper quantities of ammunition and take it directly to the fighting unit.
I'd give them the coordinates of there'd be a small ammo dump with the close to the fighting unit, and they take it up there and drop it off.
Right.
And those guys had to unload it. And stack it accordingly.
Right.
And keep him supplied with all the ammunition.
So you were moving every day, I guess.
And we were moving every day,
Every other day, whatever.
And establishing new coordinates, and sometimes.
How difficult was it to move your company? You had all these tents and all this support gear, I guess, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, we got all that in our training, you know,
how to break it down, a little
crew that would move the big tent for the headquarters.
Yeah.
And we'd have our little individual tents on our back, you know.
Sleeping in a pup tent.
A pup tent.
Yeah.
Sometimes we'd command near a house or something like that, but mostly in tents.
But in the early days,
tents, yeah.
Now, exactly. Pup tent, you had half the tent, somebody else had half the tent. And so the two of you shared
A
pup tent.
That's right. And we learned how to do the trench. So if it's raining, it'd roll off, you know.
Yeah, right. Now, what did you do? What did you carry with you at that point, Ralph? Do you remember what? Now, you had your what uniform were you wearing?
Fatigues.
You're wearing fatigues. What were you carrying on your person? You had a steel helmet, I assume.
Had a steel helmet. That's right.
Helmet liner too, I assume.
And we had the usual mess kit and the canteen and we had a 45 automatic with us.
How many rounds would you carry for your 45?
We'd have it loaded and.
Several clips?
Clips, yeah. A couple of clips to back us up.
And did you have a trenching tool?
Oh, yeah. We had a little shovel.
Have any K-rations or anything like that?
Well, normally we didn't carry them with us, but they were immediately available.
Okay.
And
is that what you normally ate, or did you have a mess tent anywhere?
No. We had K-rations. They were not bad.
What's in a K-ration?
We had some kind of meat and a veggie and
all a little tin can.
A little tin can, and if you could heat it, it was quite good.
You had a little can opener, or did break off, or what?
Yeah, a can opener. Yeah,
a little can opener.
We'd have that all that with us.
And your mess kit and
the mess kit, yeah.
And you could heat it. And it tasted fairly good. Were a hungry guy, I'm sure.
Well, I grew up poor. And Ben said, when I was a kid, I was hungry, and I was particular, like some of the guys were. It was all right. It was satisfactory.
How about water? Any trouble getting water?
No, we had no trouble getting water.
A big water tank? Or what did you do?
We'd have a water tank somewhere available. And if we got loose, we'd... scooping many times we did this in the old creek, fill it up and put in the little pellet in
the halogen tablet.
It was okay. Some people wouldn't think so, but we drank all kinds of water. But usually we had.
Were you under fire at all in this case?
We had command of the air at that time, so our ammunition dumps were fairly secure. One time we were going down the road and got strafed, and I don't think he was with a single plane, and I don't think he was very serious because we jumped out to the ditch and he could have hit us, but he kept going because we had command of the skies, and
Of course, this was tough fighting, and even right out ahead of you, that was.
Oh, indeed.
It was tough fighting.
Patton ran into some real Lulus, indeed he did.
Now this was this time frame. Now you're talking about basically June, July. How long did it take for you to get beyond, maybe I don't know, maybe 100 miles from the beach, or you know, just pick a number. Did you make much progress with any rapid speed, or do you recall how fast you moved forward?
Patton moved faster than anybody else, the miles per hour.
How many miles you went?
I mean, the distance per day or whatever. I didn't keep track of it. Patton moved steadily, except when he ran out of gasoline a couple of times, and he was moving faster than his logistics was.
Yeah, right.
And he ran out of gasoline and ammunition a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But that was rectified pretty quickly.
Well, how hard was it to keep up with him?
Well, it wasn't hard for us in the battalion, and three companies had no problem because we didn't get too loaded down with ammunition. It's just a day's supply usually.
Yeah, because you really didn't have much.
No, once we got the amount needed and got it in, that was it.
Okay.
One interesting event as we traveled through France, we were on the right plane, and we took Paris, the Third Army did,
mm-hmm.
And Eisenhower, in order to maintain good relations, he let Charles de Gaulle, the general called Charles, take the city. Much to this disgust of Patton, because Patton didn't like these little niceties that Eisenhower assumed. But anyway, Paris went crazy, and we just kind of observed, and Paris went wild, and we enjoyed it.
Now, did you go through the streets of Paris?
We went through the streets.
Tell me what that was like.
Well, our guys were out just enjoying the frenzy. The Parisians were just ecstatic because Paris were finally liberated.
Yeah.
They were out. I ran across a circus, and I went through the park, and people.
Were the women crawling on the tanks and everything, and kissing the soldiers and all this stuff?
Yeah, some of that went on. Yeah. So it was fun, but we didn't tarry that long. We kept going.
Yeah.
And when we hit Epinal, the Battle of the Bulge burst forth.
Okay, so this is in December now.
This is middle of winter. Yeah.
Yeah,
the coldest they say in 40 years, coldest winter they'd had.
And when the battle started, where were you located?
We were on the right flank with the Patton's Third Army,
uh-huh.
Following him through Europe, and we woke up one morning. We was almost on the border of Germany, a town named Epinal, France, and. Patton and his tanks were gone.
Tanks were gone?
Yeah, they were gone.
Yeah, okay.
And we wondered what the fuck of that was. Well, he'd got his tanks and raced north to the Battle of the Bulge to help help stop the German
advance.
There. And you know the story about the Battle of the Bulge. I wasn't there, so you know as much about it as I do. And I lost my favorite cousin up there, and there was some heavy losses on our side.
Absolutely.
But they finally stemmed them up. But the 7th Army was coming up from the south at that time, and we joined the 7th Army and went into Germany with the 7th Army.
Who was the commander of the 7th Army at that time?
Patch. Patch, P-A-T-C-H. Yeah,
Alexander Patch.
Patch, uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Very good. One little episode, you must say, well, we were going through France, and we had a little bit of a lull. Our officers decided, well, we've been on the sea rations a long time. Let's see if we can find a hotel around here and have a good meal. And said, who'll go make the reservations? I said, you don't ever do that. I raised my hand. I had 2 years of experience in high school, 2 years in college, and I thought I had it made. So I made the reservation, and the big day came, and we went and reported for a big meal. And the escort.
Now this is a regular French restaurant operating normally.
Relatively. The guy came up and I approached him, and he took our little group. We went up one flight of stairs, another flight of stairs. And if you know your French, all these things they don't talk English like we talk English. I only thing I could reserve was the grand chambre, and I thought that would be the big dining room. Well, the grand chambre in French colloquialism is a bridal suite. So he ushered into the bridal suite. Well, my career as an interpreter ended precipitously. I was in the
dog. You got what you asked for.
Yeah, I got what I asked for, and we finally got it straightened out.
Yeah, you got it straightened out.
But you know, that at one other time, we thought we were going to get a good meal, and most time we got dried eggs for the entree.
Well, tell me about your meal at this restaurant. Was it good?
No.
It was not
no,
good?
No. They were short of everything. And,
well, that figures.
I see ration was better than what we got there.
So it was by no means operating normally.
No, indeed it was not. And we kept a small stock of chemical ammunition right close to our headquarters. And that was guarded by some
like phosphorus shells or something.
They used it with the type they used in World War I. This sort of, and it had been outlawed. But we kept them there just to let the Germans know we had them. So if they started to use chemical weaponry, we were going to retaliate immediately.
With poisonous gases.
Exactly.
All the stuff.
And, we kept that real close to headquarters, and they were in a very close guard by the chemical officers and their guard. I think maybe that had some bearing on they're not using it, because they knew that if they did, they'd be retaliated against. We never used it, and they never used chemical weapons in World War II.
Right.
So that was a plus.
So getting on into January of 45 now, approximately, and
uh-huh,
so forth?
Uh-huh.
Is this about when you went to the restaurant? Somewhere along the way, early 45? Okay. So what were you still trying to keep up with General Patch then?
Patch, yeah.
And
we went into Bavaria, in the southern part of the flank.
Oh, okay.
And
do you remember any of the cities you went through in Bavaria?
I don't. I know we finally wound up the 7th on the headquarters at Heidelberg.
Uh-huh.
That's
okay.
where we finally settled.
You settled in Heidelberg.
The rest of the time we were. There's a lot of faces where we ran up against, and people gapping at us and.
Yeah.
And some of them were cheering us a little bit.
The Germans.
The Germans.
Did you have a chance to interact at all with any of the Germans in your position?
No. Patton put out. Eisenhower put out a an order, no fraternization.
Yeah.
Of course, that's all he knew, put it out. We were not supposed to fraternize with the Germans.
In any way,
in
you're
any
not
way.
Supposed to speak to them.
Unless
official duty or something.
Yeah, initially, but that didn't last long. We began to interact with them, and
so were you in Heidelberg quite a long time?
Yeah, Heidelberg. Yeah, our war ended. When was it? May the sixth. Yeah, May the sixth. Yeah.
Seventh, somewhere along about that. Fifth or sixth. I forgot which.
And everybody was anxious to go home.
Yeah. Now, when you were following General Patch, you still were up close with the troops and so forth.
Still a lot of casualties being taken and so forth. In our particular unit, our casualties were—I don't think we lost a single man—but up just in front of us, Pat was taking some heavy losses.
Now, did you become aware of the as the Germans surrendered? Were you anywhere near the troops that had surrendered?
Can
you describe them?
A couple of times, the surrendered troops and a lot of them are wounded, and we pass them. We go going forward, and they were coming to the rear, under guard.
Uh-huh.
And they were in bad shape.
Did you notice were there a lot of older men and boys and so forth? Were you able to see anything like that? I understand that's what happened toward the end of the war.
I didn't identify the real older men. I saw middle-aged men and young boys, not kids.
You didn't see any young boys? It might be 10, 11, 12.
No, nothing like that.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there were some like that. Yeah. But
So how did they look? Did they look healthy bedraggled?
They were horrible looking. Many of them were wounded, and they were very bedraggled.
Yeah.
And some of them...
Glad their war is over, probably.
I'm sure they were.
Yeah.
I'm sure they were. Yeah.
Okay, so in Heidelberg, then, you were still doing your thing with the 7th Army? But you were kind of doing it from that central...
The war was over, and all at once I found myself 7th Army ammunition officer. The other guy had been sent home, our main mission at that time was to help get rid of all these anti-tank bombs all over Germany. They were all over
anti-tank
bombs and explosives that were all over the roads.
Anti-tank with the mine? You're talking
yeah,
about mines?
Yeah, mines. Yeah, anti-tank bombs and mines. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
And we tried to get some our special to do it, but. We lost a couple, and then we went to the prisoner of war camps and got some German ammunition experts and got them to doing it.
Tell me about these mines. What did they look like? You ever see one?
Most of them were round, and if a tank ran over them, they were deadly.
What set them off? What set them off?
Weight would set them off. Yeah.
There wasn't a little. Plunger or anything, and that.
Well,
just...
that would be weight. Yeah, I'm sure they there was a plunger, but weight had to hit the plunger.
Some weight hit the plunger. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. And some of them were what they call Panzerfaust, P-N-Z-E-R-F-E-U-S-C, or something like that, and they were long, elongated things, they were very explosive too. All they had to do was just run over it.
Were those also pressure?
Pressure activated. Yeah. Uh-huh. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, tell me how they got rid of those mines. What did they do?
Well, ammunition experts would try to defuse them of whatever was the sensitive part of the bomb was.
How did they find
it? Sometimes it would if they if they were not, if it didn't have a heavyweight to set them off, they loaded them on trucks, and that's how, and then just haul them to the demolition dump, uh-huh. and then exploded them.
How did they find these mines? Use a mine detector and
Mine detectors, and you could see some of them, but mine detectors in particular. You know.
Could the weight of a man set a mine off?
It could if it hit it just right. If like these, like you see these little plungers sticking up, if right, you step yeah. Right on top of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It could. Yeah. And that was our main mission.
When they cleared a minefield, how did they indicate that it was cleared? Did they put markings on it?
They would put a marking on it.
Uh-huh. On the side and say, this is a safe road now?
A safe road now.
All the mines are gone?
Mm-hmm.
So you could tell if you were driving a tank or whatever down the road, you could see that it had
been
cleared.
You could see that it's okay, yeah.
It's been cleared. Yeah. Now, did you ever come across any of the roads that had been booby-trapped with a wire across?
No, we heard a lot about that, a little story about that. I was out one day inspecting one of the ammunition dumps in Europe, and Patton had put out on an order that officers were not to drive a jeep. Uh-huh. And it was a cold day, and I didn't want to keep somebody sitting in the jeep for an hour while I inspected some of the ammo piles. And I went across the road, and I got caught. He had an MP out there, and I was driving the jeep by myself.
Yeah.
In direct violation of
Patton's
order. And I was,
what, no officers were to drive? Is that the idea?
That's right. That was an order.
You had to have an enlisted man drive?
But what I'm getting to, there was a reason behind it. There was a good order. Because the driver cannot be alert by watching the place going and running into this wire that you're talking about, and that sort of thing. They're also supposed to be alert, on the alert for all these booby traps that may be involved.
Yeah.
And that's the reason he put out the order. It sounded ridiculous at first, but there was a reason behind it.
Right.
Anyway, I was driving it, and I got charged with a court martial, which would have charged me much pay. And,
so you were court martialed?
I got the summons. I got a ticket. He had the MP out there. I was driving in direct
violation
of a superior officer of his orders. And I knew that, but I didn't think I'd hit an MP. But anyway,
Call you up before your commanding officer and try you, or what do they do? Or was it automatic?
It's automatic, and it goes on your record. It's automatic forfeiture, one was paid, and a bad mark on your record, court martial.
Well, that got your attention then, didn't it?
Yeah. But anyway, I started to drive off, and he called me back. He said, well, I said, I'm going to tear this up this time, but if I get caught and not giving you a ticket, I'm going to be court-martialed. He says, don't you do it again. And I didn't. You're talking about the wires across the
people.
Yeah,
the windshield.
That was very prevalent there, particularly at night. You'd be driving fairly fast at night, even in your territory.
Yeah.
But as they retreated, that's a favorite trick that they pulled on us, that sort of thing.
So you needed to keep your windshield up, I guess.
You did.
You kept your windshield down, you could get that wire.
You could be decapitated and come home without a head or something like that.
Right.
That's right. Yeah, that was quite often.
I'd heard of that from some other gentleman I interviewed.
Yeah, that was, particularly they would pull those tricks as they retreated and leave all kind of traps that they could think of.
Was there much evidence of any, a booby trap? Was there any evidence of other sabotage or anything that you were aware of at that time, where the Germans would come in and blow up an ammunition dump or anything of that nature?
Not that I'm aware of. They were retreating, didn't have much opportunity to blow up.
Fairly secure as you
went? Yeah, as we went forward, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, was there any evidence of any of the German people doing any dirty tricks that you're aware of?
No, I didn't run into
that. Not aware of that. Okay.
I think that by and large, most of them were just glad it's over.
Yeah.
Because they had
now the individual German when you were in Heidelberg, did you ever? I know Eisenhower's orders were not to fraternize, but did you ever have occasion, maybe under official duties, to deal with the German people?
No. As a matter of fact, those orders were thoroughly relaxed to the point that the USO started putting on dances for any remaining GIs around.
And the German girls would come?
The German girls and displaced persons, any girls around that could get there.
Yeah.
And I dropped in on a couple of them, we did a lot of fraternizing regardless of the previous order.
Yeah.
You see,
there were a lot of German war brides, so there.
Oh yeah, oh,
there
yeah,
were obviously a lot of U.S. soldiers who fell in love with German women.
Yeah, there's a German war bride lives right here in Carolina Meadows.
Is that right?
She married a guy, and he's deceased now, but she's here now.
She's here, a German war bride.
Mm-hmm.
How about it?
And
that's interesting.
Well, my wife.
Anyway, you're in high. Excuse me, your wife what?
My wife was a Kraut, and our family came over from the Rhineland and somewhere in there.
Oh.
So I call her my beautiful Kraut, and she called me her handsome Limey. That was a bit derogatory name, like you said. Well, and we had a lot of fun with it.
Now, were you able to just digress a little bit? Were you able to write letters to your wife regularly?
Oh, yeah.
Did you correspond
indeed,
at all?
Indeed we did. And I kicked myself many a time that I didn't save all of her letters.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
And I that's one of my great omissions in life. Indeed we did.
Yeah, I can believe that.
We used the email in those days, and it was very effective.
Yeah, V-mail was really
V-mail.
Yeah, it's easy to make the change. Okay, let me ask a couple other questions here. Could you tell any difference between the officers that you dealt with that were, say, academy men, West Point guys versus the guys who were 60-day wonders or whatever.
90-day wonders, yeah.
Or 90-day wonders, whatever they were.
No, pretty much all the same.
What did you think about your leadership that you had during the war years? The leadership, the men that you reported to, were they good, sound individuals most of them?
Yeah.
And you didn't have any 8 balls out there?
No. They were good, solid people, and we all got along. Excellently.
Did you have any problem with any of the fellows that you were in your company that were worried about the war and had any kind of psychological problems or this kind of thing? Anybody like that you were of?
No.
Or were you further back enough that it didn't affect them that much?
No psychological problem. When we got word that we were hitting, going across the channel, a few of the men we had a little trouble with.
They didn't want to go?
They didn't want to go.
They didn't want to go. I wouldn't want to go particularly either, but you got to.
Yeah, you got to, yeah.
That's your job.
Yeah, to the point they said, I ain't going.
Oh, I'm not going. Now, were these guys that finally did go, or did they? What did they do with those guys?
A couple of them, it was pretty serious. They were, they had to go back and face a court martial.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, right.
But
how was your discipline in your group?
It was good.
No particular problems with that?
No.
How about drugs? Not drugs particularly, but gambling and this kind of thing.
Gambling, but no heavy gambling that I know
nothing
of.
Nothing that was just serious.
Fun, just fun gambling.
Any guys who took off AWOL or anything particularly, or you have any of that?
Well, going to Europe. Well, we had one serious problem, but I'm not going to comment on that.
How about any discrimination that you know of particularly? Was there any of that, or did you all get along well together, regardless of race, ethnic origin, or anything else?
When we were in training at Portsmouth, Virginia, that time we had a black thing, and they went to town and had a little problem in Norfolk, Virginia, and that was a serious racial thing.
Okay, yeah.
We finally got it resolved, but that was a biggie. And at that time, you know, we had segregation.
Time. Absolutely.
So it was a biggie.
Did you ever go back for any R&R, Ralph? Did you know, rest and recreation from the
No, I didn't.
You were kind of going pushing all the time.
We were pushing all the time.
Yeah. Okay. Did you ever see the USO or Red Cross people do anything that you helped you, or USO, you know, the Red Cross and so forth?
Well, there was the
USO at Heidelberg, I think.
They were on the grounds immediately with all kinds of recreational activities. Yeah. And the Red Cross was often that. At the Rio Echelon with coffee and donuts any way they could help.
Yeah. How about the health of your unit? Did you have a medic attached to your company?
No, we did not, because we were a separate entity, a company. We weren't big enough. But we always had medical
attention if we needed it. How did you keep up with the progress of the war? Did you read Stars and Stripes and so forth? Did you get that?
Oh, yeah. We got the Stars and Stripes. Yes, we did.
Did you get it regularly or pretty often?
Yes, sporadically.
Sporadically. I didn't figure they had a mailboy that dropped it off that day. But you saw it often enough to kind of keep up with what was going on.
Roughly, we get used to the progress.
Yeah. Did you ever have a radio and listen to... Axis Sally or any of the...
We had a radio, but we just the Germans had the same victory march that we did. What was it? There was something today.
Yeah, let me get that back up there. These darn microphones have a way of messing up here. Okay.
Well, anyway, we listened to the radio. We had a radio.
Now, when you were listening to the radio, you were picking up an English station then, or
Mostly German.
Mostly German.
Mostly German, and they were quite good. A lot of good music.
Really,
a lot of good music.
That's interesting.
A little propaganda there.
Even as you were marching toward the knockabout.
No, we were not on the march. No,
No, I mean when you stopped, though. I mean you had a radio.
Yeah, we had a radio. Somebody had a radio. And we enjoyed the music.
That's amazing, but you never heard like Axis Sally or Lord Haw Haw or any of those.
No, I didn't hear them.
That was probably a little earlier. I think most Lord Haw Haw committed suicide, I believe. Okay. Did you have any opinion of the enemy? You know, you didn't get that close to him in combat, but did you develop any opinion of the enemy that you were facing? You know, that you could say, hey, these guys are really know what they're doing and they're tough guys, or they're ready to, they're just to run out of gas, or they're ready to surrender. Did you have any feeling?
My impression was that they were tough guys and had to be dealt with, and it was going to be extremely difficult for them to capitulate.
And then at the end, I'm sure you, with the condition that you saw them at the end,
yeah,
So they would run just totally capitulated, I guess.
The Russians all coming in from one side and the Allies on the other, they were squeezed to death.
Oh, yes. Now tell me about your mail. How often did you get mail?
Now, regularly. The V-mail was very good. They developed
Once a week or
whatever? At least once a week. Uh-huh.
And you were able to correspond and write and mail your letters back?
Indeed, we were. Yeah.
Okay.
That was good.
Okay, did you have any interaction at all with any, you never had any personal interaction with any prisoners of war or anything, did you, other than seeing them walk by?
Just observation.
Yeah. Okay, what decorations, what medals did you get, Ralph? I know you got some.
Well.
Victory medal?
I just finished this,
what is this you're looking at now?
This includes my wartime.
Let's see what this ancestral here. There you go.
That's and the cool. What we're talking about. I didn't know how you're going to approach this.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And I pinned this off. That deals with War II.
Yeah. Okay.
And
okay.
Well, that's a question.
It's a little book that Ralph wrote here on historical data.
World War II participated in Army beach landings, then assigned to General Patton's 3rd U.S. Army. We covered that. Campaign through Europe included Northern France, General Central Europe, and the Rhineland Offensive. And that's War II that I go into.
Court. Right. Okay.
And the decorations.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Army Commendation Medal, World War II Victory Medal. That's Army. That's occupation. Army occupation medal.
Right.
Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal. Overseas service with multiple stars.
Okay. Now, Ralph, the war was over basically, and you were still in Heidelberg, I guess, were you not? And how many did you have enough points to get out at that point, or did you?
Well, the only thing, the big thing, Ken, was transportation. We had millions of guys in Europe, and that was one fact. We just didn't have the ships and planes to take them back in 24 hours. We had to wait our turn.
Right, sure.
And the war was still raging in the Far East.
Sure.
And there was some talk, I don't recall now whether it was gossip or valid, that some of us might be transferred over there.
Right.
Because they had not hit the mainland of Japan at that time. And as I understand it, had they done that, well, every man, woman, and child in Japan had been taught to fight to the death.
Right.
And they anticipated, according to the figures I read, 1 million casualties.
Right.
The Norman invasion would have been a Sunday school picnic compared to we might hit over there.
Absolutely.
And that's where that kind of Armageddon coming up, we were all serving to be transferred to the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
What capacity, what they needed was not determined at that time. And then they were a little slow in getting us home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we were expected immediate gratification, but it was not to be. So it was a little while before, for those two reasons, before we could all get out of there and
right.
get back to our home. But finally, I did.
Yeah.
And
so where did you went through Camp Lucky Strike or one of those camps there, or did you go right to England and leave from England?
No, I went from the Camp Lucky Strikes there, I went of course to New York. Everybody did, I guess. And my wife was there to meet me, and
well, now that must have been thrilling. How did you find her? There must have been thousands of people waiting for that ship.
As I recall, they were waiting at to Harvard, they got the word. They were there. They found us. We didn't have to find them.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, did your wife? You got off the ship, and were you able to find her right away?
Yeah, we found her right.
Isn't that amazing?
We had a night together.
And, fantastic.
She had driven up there, and we drove back home. Drove back to North Carolina.
Yeah.
That was quite a deal. And
hold on just a second. Okay, so you drove back to North Carolina and tried to resume a normal life.
And my immediate trip was to Fort Bragg to get cashiered out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I like a lot of others, so they approached me first about being a reserve officer. That's why not? They pick up much time, and then. I was approached again. How about you applying for also in the regular army? Well, I don't know. But finally, I said, "Why not? I can always decline if it's offered." So I went to a batter of tests, interviews and the usual tests to see if you got the sense, IQ test. And I went home, went back with the Texas Oil Company, and forgot about it all.
Uh-huh.
And
you were in the reserves, though, right?
I was in the reserves. Yeah, yeah.
Did you have a reserve training obligation where you had to do it once a month?
I did not get involved in that.
No training, but you were still in the reserves.
I was in the reserve. That's right.
Okay. All right.
And
they didn't pay you anything, in other words, either.
No, they did not pay me anything. Okay. Exactly. And so the Texas Oil sent me as a salesman up in Richmond, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife is still working down in Greensboro.
Okay, we're good.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side 2. The interview continues on tape B, side 1.
I was saying I went to Richmond, and then they transferred me over to Charlotte, and I would come home on Saturday and have to leave Sunday afternoon to go back to work, and I got kind of tired of that. And about concurrent with that, I got a communication from the president, offered me a regular army commission. I read it by my wife, and she said, "You don't want to do that, do you?" That's what she always said, but she didn't want me to do that. And but I was sitting in the hotel one night, lonesome and feeling sorry for myself, and I said, "Why not?" I said, "Golly, I think I have a better family life in the army than this life I got now." So I wired back and said yes. I went home, told my wife what I'd done. And she said, "You did?" I said, "I did." But she's a people person, and she enjoyed it, I think.
How long did you actually stay in the service then? When were you finally released?
July 1966.
You finally got out.
I was at NATO and.
Let's carry through your military experience.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, you went back into the service on regular commission in what year, would you say, when you got your regular Army commission? About 1949 or 50 or something?
Approximately. Back to the regular.
That's close enough.
Yeah.
What did you do then with your, well, just carry through your...
First assignment was Atlanta, Georgia to Ordnance Complex down there. And I served there for 3 years.
So, what were your duties down there?
I was supposed to work on organizations, and under the supervision of the commanding officer.
Mm-hmm.
And
what were you, a first lieutenant or a captain this time?
At that time, I was a captain.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And from there, I was assigned to Ordnance or the advanced school that's in in Maryland. And that was a 9-month affair.
Okay.
And from there, I went to the Pentagon. And I served there in the weapons section, so the Pentagon. And I left from there and went to Korea. I was assigned to Korea. I bought a bought a home there on paper and
in
Washington D.C.
Washington D.C.
And so it's been ready in 6 months, and in 2.5 years it wasn't ready. And finally, the guy said, "Well, it's ready." And I was in the carpool with a guy down at personnel, and I said, and I asked him that morning. I said, "Am I ready to be transferred out of here? Am I gonna be here for a year?" He said, "No, you'll be here for a couple of years yet." I said, "Okay, I'll go ahead and move my new home." And very next morning, he called me. He said, "I got a great big requisition here for Korea, and you're on it." Ooh. I said, "Well, why didn't you tell me so?" I said, "I'd already paid a dollar down for furniture and stuff like that for my new home." I said, "Okay, I'll go to work and cancel out," and I did. And so Korea was my next assignment there. And I commanded the Army Depot there in Busan, Korea, while I was there, which was a couple of years.
Now, you were in Busan. Now, were the North Koreans coming down toward you? What was your situation?
The big action was around the parallel line. 38th parallel line, yeah. And I was back and forth to the front line, kind of see how the equipment was reaching the troops. And that was fairly calm, except once in a while they stopped the train and take care of the people on the train. We slept with our ammunition and weapons on our pillow all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, again, we had they did not have an air force.
Mm-hmm.
We would have been a prime target.
Yeah,
had the air force, but as it was, it was fairly safe.
Now, were you there after MacArthur had invaded and so forth in the north? Was this after the 38th parallel had been stabilized? North Korea and South Korea were separated.
There was still a lot of action up there, but
action.
There was a lot of action. Otherwise, we'd have closed the depot and come home.
Okay.
I was there for 2 years, and then I was transferred to Tokyo, where we set up the depot Tokyo Arsenal. They had when they couldn't repair the trucks and the tanks and the equipment in the field, they'd have to send them back to the United States or send new stuff over. And we set up the arsenal there in Tokyo and manned it with Japanese people. They were very good technicians, as you know.
Yeah.
And we saved a lot of time on the turnaround time, and they repaired our equipment and saved some millions of dollars.
Mm.
And I was there until they transferred me back to the United States. And from there, I went to Army Depot in Chambersburg, which was a backup port for the New York port. We had everything there.
Chambersburg, PA.
You're right. Chambersburg. Yeah.
Yeah, Chambersburg.
Exactly.
Pennsylvania.
Very good. And from there, they sent me to a tour in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
You may recall, we were having a lot of trouble with Russia at the time.
Oh, we had bases in Turkey. I know that the Russians want us to get rid of.
And Truman gave them a lot of our equipment. So they sent a small team over there of experts, maintenance people and combat people, just nucleus from the combat arms and the logistics people to be sure that, to teach them how to maintain it and to use it. Uh-huh. And I was with a small team over there for 2 years.
I see.
That was in Turkey.
Yeah.
And from there, I came back and managed a command in an old fort in out of Gallup, New Mexico. An old fort that had been there about 100 years, and while there we had the we had the 100th anniversary of that fort. And
that's not Fort Huachuca, is it?
No, Fort Wingate.
Fort Wingate.
Fort Wingate, just out of Gallup, New Mexico. And we had a big bang there that got an old Indian with a boy, with a scout, 100 years ago, with the military cavalry, and he was back squatting out in front of the his adobe that in the Navajo reservation, which is right next to our port there, and we put him in a Cadillac, and he had a ball. And the town really went.
Oh, he's a Navajo Indian scout.
Yeah.
Oh, was he a scout over in the Pacific?
No. Right in the West, in the Wild West.
Oh, the Wild West.
100 years ago, at that time, he was a scout for MacArthur's old dad, I think.
You talking about this guy right here?
Yeah, that guy right there.
No kidding.
He was in his 90s.
Oh, he was in his, gosh, he doesn't look that old. No. He was in his 90s.
No, he was squat.
So he was a scout for, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And, for MacArthur and his, John MacArthur's dad, huh?
And then the, my final tour was back with NATO in France.
Oh, okay.
And, I told my wife my retirement was coming up, and I said, "Honey, you've never had a say about where you're going to live." I said, "I walk in one day, and I said, honey, we got orders the other side of the world. Start packing." And she salute and say, "Yes, sir." And I said, "This is your call. We're retiring. You say where it'll be." She thought about a couple of days. We were from Greensboro. She says, "Well, let's move to Chapel Hill. That's a nice, quiet college town and close to home. Both our homes. Let's go there." I said, "Okay, you got it." And that's how come we're here.
Really? You never lived here before?
No.
So you moved here in 68?
66.
66.
Mm-hmm.
Moved here in 66. How about it? And you've been here?
Been here ever since.
40 years.
My wife passed away in 91.
And what was her name, Ralph?
Lois.
Lois. Oh, yes. I saw a picture over there.
This is Lois.
Oh, yes. I can see where you were infatuated with Lois. Fell in love with Lois.
No, yeah, she was my dream.
No doubt.
We had 55 beautiful years.
Do you have any children, Ralph?
I have two daughters. And,
I met one of them at church.
Yes, you did. Two daughters and two granddaughters. I had a harem for a while, and then I had the boys start popping out. One grandson and two great grandsons.
Okay.
So I've been in the circle a little bit.
But just. Two daughters, you say?
Two daughters. Uh-huh. Yeah, you've got one over there.
Okay.
Yes, we did.
Okay, well, Ralph, let me ask you, how can you characterize, if you feel like you can, your experience during World War II, which I think was probably the most dramatic that you've had, maybe something in Korea too, I don't know. But in your World War II experience, can you characterize it and how you felt about what you did over there and so forth?
You mean what I did? Was it worthwhile?
What you feel about what you did and what everybody else was doing too, I guess.
Well, I think it's To start with, that's probably the most popular one that we've ever had.
Yeah.
Everybody was behind it.
That's right.
Except, Lindbergh and Ford and a couple,
yeah, there were
a couple of well-known people, yeah, who were not.
That's right.
But 99% were behind it. Even the families were behind, yeah, us, what we did. It's fun. Soon as I went over, my wife put on a campaign of asking everybody to sit around. Why aren't you there? And she said, she talked to one good friend of ours, says, why don't you, got your uniform on? My husband was over there. And he was a good friend. He said, well, Lois says, I tried, but for that, they won't let me in.
Yeah.
And she said she'd never ask anyone else.
Yeah.
And that was, she had no business asking anyway. But anyway, in the first place, everybody concedes, I think, that it's worth the effort of in lies. 400,000 of our guys didn't come back. And 16 million of others were involved. And there was a biggie.
It was.
We talk biggest thing we ever had.
Yeah, 55 million or more people died in the war, during the wartime.
Yeah. And the logistics support from the home front was absolutely marvelous. We managed to turn around and furnished us with all the equipment we needed, and our allies too.
Did you ever have any shortage of equipment, particularly?
A couple of times, but it's just it's a glitch in the supply line. It was on the way, but we had temporary shortages.
Yeah.
But we had everything we needed. the experts said our tanks weren't quite as good as the Germans, but Patton did all right with them.
Well, he had gasoline and ammunition. The Germans frequently didn't have gasoline
nor
ammunition.
Touche, yeah. And I guess if I'd have been, if I'd have went on the first wave on the Norman invasion, I wouldn't be here. If I'd been in maybe a front line of infantry, I probably wouldn't be here.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I tried to get in infantry, but they wouldn't have it because of my sight.
Yeah.
I did the best I could, and I think everybody did. That's no heroics about that. But
something you had to do. We as a nation had to do.
And we did it willingly and enthusiastically, and we did the job. That's one war if we never fight another one. Hope we don't. It's the kind of way to do it, with everybody's support, no dissenters, no marching against it.
Yeah. How did your World War II experience change your life, if it did?
Absolutely. Had it not been for World War II, I'd probably be in Greensboro working for the Texas Oil Company now. It changed everybody's life. I would say at least 99% of our lives.
Of course, it gave you a military career.
It gave me a military career, yeah. Right,
which you probably wouldn't.
And I had never thought of having a military career, never thought a thing about it. And, when you're young, you don't think about those things. It might be your education, but that's about all you think about.
Yeah.
I'd still be, never have left North Carolina. When our company went out to Fort Lewis, Washington, I expect 90% of that bunch had never left the boundaries of North Carolina before. And prior to World War II, I read somewhere that 90% of the people in North Carolina were born in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. We were homebound. And it started a mobile society, which we're still faced with today.
Yeah.
If that's good or bad, I don't know.
It's a fact.
It's just a fact. And before that, we had families were born in a given area. They lived in a given area. And we died in a given area and went to heaven from that given area.
Right.
And grandma took care of the kids, and later the kids took grandma and grandpa.
Right.
And they didn't have to farm us out to warehouses like Carolina Meadows to get rid of us. And it's just a different society since World War II did it, I think.
Right. Yeah, it did.
At least had a big impact on our
lives. It had a big influence on
us.
Indeed
it did. Now we're a mobile society. We got people here who have kids overseas and see them every once every 5 years. That's kind of sad, I think.
Yeah, it is that.
Yeah.
It is that.
So,
do you have any experience that you can point to now that kind of rings in your memory about those years? Any particular experience that characterizes your time in the service or anything? Might be sad experience or even a funny experience, I don't know.
Well, no, World War II, I think this is sad. I lost my best friend.
Yeah.
He went down over to Italy, and I lost my best baby cousin at the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah.
And those were sad events.
Yeah.
And, and of course, that was unusual. There were just 1 or 400,000 of the guys who were lost.
Right.
And it's just it's kind of sad to say that it was a successful war when you think of all those who lost a loved one in that war.
Yeah.
Because how can it be
a high cost for success?
A high cost for success.
Absolutely.
But it's behind us, and we hope that we'll make the best of it and learn from it.
Right. Okay, Ralph, you got anything else you want to add before we close this up?
I think I've said enough. I don't like to talk. I like to listen.
Well, we've talked for a little while.
Yeah.
We've talked for a little while. Okay, well, this will conclude our interview with Mr. Ralph Todd, and good to be with you, Ralph, and we'll see you Sunday night.
Thank you, Ken.
Sunday,
at church, yeah.
Okay, right, bye.
Yeah, thank you, Ken.
As a postscript to my interview with Ralph, I want to mention some of the other things that Ralph has done. He did undergraduate work at Guilford College in Greensboro, North Carolina, King's Business College in Greensboro, Georgia State in Georgia, University of Metz in France, University of Sofia, Tokyo, Japan, and the University of Maryland, from which he received his Bachelor of Science degree. Ralph also did graduate work, gaining a master's in education from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He attended various military schools, Officers Canada School, Advanced Schools, Officers Training, Top Management Seminar, Emergency Management of the National Economy, Guided Missile and Special Weapons, and Nuclear Weapons Orientation. Based on his education, he was issued a certificate by the North Carolina State Department of Education to teach and work in North Carolina schools in the areas of school administration, i.e. principal of a school, school psychologist, history, and counseling. His medals and decorations from the Army included the Army Commendation Medal, World War II Victory Medal, the Republic of Korea Presidential Citation, the Army of Occupation Medal, the Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal, and the Army Overseas Service Ribbon with multiple stars. Ralph and his wife, Lois, retired to the town of Chapel Hill, North Carolina in 1966, and on completion of the graduate degree at UNC, worked with the Durham County School System for 12 years. He was the mayor of a resort area from 1980 to 1986, and has been a member of Mount Carmel Baptist Church, Sons of the Confederacy Veterans, and the American Legion. He moved to Carolina Meadows, a Chapel Hill retirement community, in 1987. Ralph talked a little bit about his career as a musician, and he did play the trumpet and did many a gig, apparently, over the years, including being part of the entertainment at Carolina Meadows for some time. This interview and the information...
Editor's note. End of tape B, side one. The interview continues on tape B, side two.
The information that I've compiled on this interview from Ralph would not be complete without speaking about his wife, Lois. She was born March 6, 1919, and died of cancer February 14, 1991. And they had 55 wonderful years together. Lois grew up during the hard times of the Depression, as did Ralph. She had five siblings, the same as Ralph, and her dad had left the family early on, leaving her mother to care for the children. For many years, for tax assistance, she worked with them until she resigned to travel with Ralph in his military experience. Lois had a beautiful voice. She sang in school choruses and the Greensboro church choirs. She studied voice as a special student at Greensboro College and did some professional singing and also sang in choral groups throughout the world. In her military travels with Ralph, if there was a hospital nearby, she always did extensive volunteer work. When Ralph was commanding officer of Fort Wingate, New Mexico, she and one of the staff members of the fort established a state employees credit union for the benefit of the employees. During the 55 years that she and Ralph were married, she gave her full support to Ralph. And of course, when she thought Ralph was wrong, she would pull him up to a full stop. When Ralph was ready to retire out of his NATO assignment in France, the military would move him any place in the world. And he asked Lois to tell him where she would like to be, since she had never had much choice in the past. So she thought of it a couple of days and said, "Let's move to Chapel Hill." And Ralph told her, "That's it. That's what we're going to do." And that's what they did. At the University of North Carolina, she was offered and accepted a position at the University Dental School. Later, the university organized the Dental Research Department, and Dr. Philip Hirsch was named to head it up. Dr. Hirsch later advised me that due to her outstanding work, he had asked that Lois be transferred with him to the new organization as his administrative assistant. If she had not done this, he would not have taken this new directorship, which is quite a testimonial to Lois's abilities. As part of Lois's duties, she edited many of the professional publications coming out of that new department, and her name is listed as editor on several of these. Lois was absolutely a master of the King's English, and in Ralph's graduate work, he had numerous papers to prepare, and if he could get Lois to edit the paper for spelling, grammar, sentence structure, etc., he did. She had the uncanny ability of detecting any slight defect at a glance. She never rewrote Ralph's papers, but simply jotted down questions for him to consider for a rewrite. Her editing work was the difference between a mediocre versus a top grade in the class. And Lois and Ralph had two beautiful daughters, Patricia and Karen, who are the delight of Ralph's life now. And from this, he has two granddaughters, Elaine and Norma, and one grandson, Kevin, and two great-grandsons, John and Michael. And at age 95, in 2008, Ralph says his entire extended family has and does give him the utmost joy and pleasure. And as Ralph says, he has been extremely blessed. Thanks be to God. I hope you've enjoyed this bit of extra information on Ralph and his family. This is the end of the interview and additional information from Ralph Todd.